Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Andrew Hoag, CEO of TeamPay, coming to us from New York. Andrew, how's your day going?
It's good. It's good. It's sunny here today. We've had a couple nor'easters, so I'm happy to see the sunshine.
Very nice. Very nice. And you're not down at South by Southwest this week?
No, too much work.
Yeah. Same here. Same here. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Tell us, what is TeamPay and why did you start this business?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. At a very macro level, TeamPay is procurement software, and it's a very boring category, and I didn't set out to develop procurement software, but it really came through a pain point that I experienced as a founder and operator, which is it constantly was a problem whenever any of my employees needed to make a purchase or buy something. And it was ranging from getting them to pay for it, so potentially sharing my card or my personal card, or getting them, reimbursed when they bought something, and then later keeping track of, okay, who bought this, what project is it for, all those sorts of issues. And it's funny because my background is on the engineering side, and I realized that as an engineer, I have better tools to keep track of my source code than I do my money. Mm. And everybody's used to like single sign-on, Facebook Connect, Google sign-on, all these kinds of things. But there really is no single sign-on for the company's bank account. And so that's really how we think about TeamPay, is that, effectively access control in front of the company's bank account, not in a negative way, but really in an empowering way. And so we make it really easy for companies to delegate spending authority down throughout their team. Allow people to make purchases without having to run down someone's card and then get the card number and then file a report 30 days later. And we automate that entire process and then centralize the reporting and control over that. And so it ends up being kind of a win-win, where both the customer, the buyer, is happy because they got to go do what they needed to do and buy what they needed to buy. The manager's happy because he literally just does one click to approve the purchase. And the finance team is happy because everything ends up in the books well-organized throughout the month, and they save a bunch of time at month-end close. So we kind of stumbled into this when I was looking at a few other markets and opportunities. And as I dug in, I was like, well, this is just such an obvious pattern and such a great place to be that we started a company around it.
Interesting. And is it a SaaS model, a subscription model, or is it? Are you taking a margin from the sellers, or something else?
Yeah, so we started out as a SaaS model, and I think there's other opportunities down the road. Like most companies, once you get a product embedded, there's some opportunities to monetize. But for us, the biggest pain point we solve for customers is around control and accountability. And larger companies typically will solve this by hiring humans. Fortunately, software is a little bit cheaper than hiring people to do the same job. And so we charge on a monthly SaaS model based on the usage. So based on how much the customer is actually using it. And then there's a SaaS pricing model attached to that.
And is it, are you targeting enterprise or small, medium-sized businesses or anyone?
Yeah. So, we've narrowed the targeting a lot. I think there's some companies that this makes sense for. Christoph Jantz has a really great chart about mice, rabbits, deer, elephants, kind of sizing SaaS businesses. And we're very much in the rabbits and deer category. So we have two segments that we go after: companies 50 to 200 employees, which is really when you start to have the next level of hierarchy in an organization and you have multiple people approving for others. And then the deer category, 200 to 1,000 employees. We now have a few customers there that we closed after the funding. And those are much larger organizations, more complex needs, more complex workflows. But that's really the primary two segments that we've been focused on so far.
Makes sense. Great. Okay. So how much have you guys raised and over how many rounds?
Yeah, so we effectively did two rounds. We did a kind of a rolling close with a safe convertible note for our pre-seed. That ended up being just under $1 million. And we closed some more of that money in 2017. And at the end of 2017, we raised an equity round of $3 million. So we raised $4 million in total. We've converted the previous notes in, and now we're using that capital really to focus on growing the business.
For the pre-seed, how did you choose a safe, or why did you choose a safe? What were your
budget there? That's actually a bit of a loaded question. I mean, I've done now every form. I did convertibles before. I think the safe was a very easy document for us to execute. We did find that there was some resistance to it on the East Coast. It's a little more common on the West Coast. And, you know, the reality is the instrument hopefully lives for a year or maybe less, and then it gets converted into a round. And that's kind of what happened to us. So it's a very short-term thing. But, you know, ultimately using a, whether it's a convertible note or a safe, we just wanted to have the mechanics of the investment be as simple and clean as possible, and to do it on a, you know, two-page agreement as opposed to negotiating a bunch of equity terms.
So for anyone who's not familiar, can you just give a very high-level overview of what a safe actually is?
Yeah, so a safe is a simple agreement for future equity. And so effectively, it's a contract to buy equity in a future round. And so it kind of sits in this, you know, depending on who you talk to, it's conveniently between or in a no man's land, in between debt, which is a convertible note, and actually doing a priced equity round. All of these instruments have different strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, the historical problem with debt is that it actually is debt. And so you have some repayment at a future date, and there's a bunch of things that come along with debt. And really the intention of a convertible note is you don't want to seize the assets of the company. So you don't want to be a debt holder. You actually want to convert into the equity piece. But, you know, there's trade-offs with all of them. And frankly, like a good corporate attorney will help you walk through whatever the best one is for your situation.
Okay, that makes sense. Did you encounter any trade-offs? I mean, you mentioned East Coast. It wasn't quite as common or commonly understood. Was that a blocker in any way with investors? Or,
I mean, I think sometimes people use the form of the instrument as an excuse. Like if they want to do the deal, they'll find a way to do the deal. That's kind of just my experience. For every rule, there's an exception. And, you know, if they like, oh, well, we don't invest in safes, like plenty of people do. And if they love the deal, they would figure out a way to invest in a safe. So I don't, you know, I think a lot of that is just, people talking around the real issue.
Finding a reason to, yeah, pass.
Yeah.
There are a thousand ways to say no. A thousand ways to, yep, say no. Okay, let's stick on this this pre-seed round for a minute. So this was angels or VCs or friends and family, or what was the makeup of that?
Yeah, so, you know, every time I do a fundraise, I try to think, you know, there's a number of pieces of advice that I give founders. Like one is, there's this concept of like smart money and dumb money, right? And there's two things that are important when you're fundraising from an external signals perspective. Like one is the smart money. So who's coming in that has some name, reputation, or social proof? And then the second signal is the total amount. And so I think it's actually important to keep the total amount and the high watermark rising. And, you know, even if you take someone who has a great reputation and they put in a dollar, nobody asks how much each person put in. And the reality is, like, having that person write you a dollar is probably more valuable than your uncle writing you $10,000 from a reputation perspective. But from a total dollars perspective, you also have to keep the number just rising as you continue to close and raise. So, you know, as I went out to kind of raise, having done this a few times before, I was actually pretty strategic about how I thought about my sources of capital. So there definitely were friends and family where they were fellow CEOs, people I'd worked with in the past that had a good network and I knew could open doors for us. And so they kind of came in as individuals on the friends and family side. Then there were angels that were more strategic, particularly around finance and SaaS. So we sought out, you know, some specific angels around the fintech and finance space as well as the SaaS space. And then finally, we actually were really fortunate in the pre-seed round to have a couple institutions. It's been interesting over the last 3 to 5 years that institutional pre-seed has become a thing. One of the funds on the West Coast, Precursor Ventures, kind of Charles really had started. He was one of the first funds doing institutional checks into pre-seed rounds. And so we had a couple institutions, and we even got a seed round, a seed fund that put in money at the early pre-seed stage as well, which you could argue has some signaling risk. But fortunately for us, it proved out not to be the case. And they were happy because they got to buy part of their investment at the cheaper price. And then they came in larger in the seed round as we closed that.
Gotcha. So in that pre-seed round, did Precursor lead it, or did anyone lead the round, I guess, in a safe, or is it more of a party round, so to speak?
I mean, I think a party round is like 20 plus investors. So we weren't a party round. I think, you know, we worked with a couple investors to set the terms, but there wasn't anyone who was, you know, angling and wrestling the docks and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, really at the pre-seed stage, what matters most is just the price. And the amount that you're raising. And so as I went through and I surveyed different people, you know, ranging kind of in the price range we were talking about, you know, we tried to come up with something that was palatable to both sides. And, you know, we ended up with some people thinking it was cheap, some people thinking it was expensive, and I was happy. And that's kind of like a good negotiation.
No, that makes sense, right? The Goldilocks approach, right?
Yeah.
So talk about price. So it's a safe, so it's not technically a priced round. So what you're negotiating there is the future. Tell us what you're actually negotiating in terms of the price.
Yeah. So there's two kind of terms on a safe that can come into play. So one is basically the investor wants some sort of a discount on the next round for the time value of their money. And so that discount may come by saying this safe will convert at a price no greater than X. So there's a ceiling on that safe, which is called a cap. And so that means like if the cap is 7 and you raise the round, the next round at 10, the safe gets additional shares as if they had invested at a $7 million valuation, right? The second feature on the safe is the discount. And so let's say the discount is 20% and there's no cap and you raise at 10, then the safe gets to buy in at 8 million. So the discount and the cap kind of play into each other. And so I think that's a really important feature for entrepreneurs to understand, because investors understand it very well. And I always built my own cap tables and I built my own dilution models because I actually had to understand how the money would convert in, and I wanted to understand the math behind it.
Yeah, that makes sense. If in that scenario, if the next round was under 7, if you set your cap at 7 and the next round came in where the company was priced at 6, there the cap is sort of irrelevant, but the discount still applies, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. I think that's a good basic explanation. And so, you know, you had institutional, some friends and family, some angels. Did you run a process at the seed round or the pre-seed round? I'm sorry. Or did you just kind of socialize this with people you knew? And
yeah, and I've done this enough times now where you kind of always start with that. You start out with this idea of like, oh, I know these people and it'll be quick and easy. And then 2 months later, you're running a process. maybe it's just the way that I approach it, or, you know, there's certain timing factors. But for me, I think you always have to run a process. And there's a few things that are beneficial. One is to have a certain amount of discipline and cadence about the round to kind of manage momentum, potentially to create competition. But if nothing else, you create some heat around the deal because people will start back channeling it. And if somebody's seen it, but other people haven't, then people will get freaked out. So I think it's always advisable. And, you know, some of my investors even said, hey, like, let's just go talk to these few people. And, you know, investors, to be honest, don't know how to raise venture money. They know how to raise LP money, but it's different. And I just think, you know, you should always plan to run a process. You should have a spreadsheet. You should have a CRM. I've started to formalize it. I keep track of people in stages. I just think that's really, really useful. I ended up using a CRM for it, and it became really helpful for me to be able to manage, you know, the contacts and all those kinds of things.
Awesome. I'll have to get you on Founder Suite for your next round. We'll set you up. That makes sense. So, and at the time you're raising this pre-seed, was the product already live in market, or is this more conceptual, you know, pre-launch?
Yeah, this is one of those things where it's, don't do what I do, but do what I say. So I had a small exit with my previous company. I'd helped a few other companies raise funding. So we actually had raised our pre-seed round pretty much on a prototype and a PowerPoint. And we had a couple team members on board at that point. But, you know, if you look at it compared to some other companies, there definitely was not as much meat on the bone, I think, as I would suggest people have. And, you know, part of it was we had gone into a big market. Second, I was bringing, you know, some actual entrepreneurial experience to the table as a serial founder. And third, you know, I probably would have been easier if I'd had gotten a little further on it. But, you know, frankly, like, we still got it done. And it just, you know, it took us about 3 months to kind of from when we started to when we got, you know, enough to really go out and start building and hiring the team and getting it fully in operation.
That makes sense. 3 months, and ballpark, how many investors do you think you talked to during that time?
Oh, on the pre-seed, I forgot the numbers now at this point. I would say it's between 60 and 100 unique contacts.
Yeah, sure.
So again, back to running a process. Now, fortunately, we closed 15 of those, I think, or actually, yeah, maybe even 19 of those. So we had a pretty good hit rate, if you look at that, in terms of unique contacts to close. But definitely it required us talking to a lot of people and kissing a lot of frogs.
Sure. Awesome. Okay, that's really useful. And just your last company, what was that company? And did you raise money for that? We won't go too deep into that hole, but...
Yeah, no. So it was... So basically that one was interesting. That's where I learned a lot of my what I call founder tuition. We raised a true friends and family round, like former employees, aunts and uncles, all of that. Very small check in 2008, right before the financial crisis, and then kind of slogged through 3 years of bootstrapping, trying to figure out what we were going to do. And then in 2011, raised a party round. We were one of the first kind of like, we're an early AngelList round when they went more public with AngelList, raised a party round there. And then we had a small exit for that company in 2012. So learned a lot about fundraising through that. And it was very educational. There was less than $1 million. It was on a convertible note, and then had a small exit and sent some investors checks last year. But it was definitely a lot of learning through that process.
Would you recommend the party round, or would you avoid that in the future? You hear sort of different things.
I mean, I'd recommend getting money any way you can.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important thing. I think the how is secondary. There definitely are challenges with people that are throwing in $5,000 or, you know, today now with the syndicates, it's like $1,000. Like, you know, they're really indexing and you're just not having that kind of like one-to-one connection or that support. And that was part of the reason I really sought out a couple institutional checks, even at our pre-seed. So we had some kind of larger funds around the table, people with a little bit more experience and people that I could lean on that were more invested in our success. So, you know, I wouldn't say never do a party round. I think getting the funds raised is more important than anything else. There's no nevers in this business. But if you have a choice, I think smaller concentrated bets from investors that are willing to roll up their sleeves and have actual skin in the game is helpful.
Very good. Can you mention the name of that company, or you can pass if you don't want to?
Well, the company that we sold was Urban Tag. One word, Urban Tag. And that was we were in TechCrunch when we sold. So that was kind of it. But yeah, small mobile app. We got acquired by a social network that subsequently got acquired. You know, built a product, built a team, raised a little bit of money, never really got to traction. And then took a few years to recover, and along came TeamPay.
All right, good. Okay, let's go now to the more recent $3 million seed round. Did you do anything differently this time? You mentioned one of the investors was already in on the pre-seed round. So did they lead the next round, the seed round?
Yeah, so here's an interesting thing about venture funds. People don't like them setting their own prices.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, generally, if you have an inside investor that wants to put in a bigger check, you know, if there's kind of the pro rata check, which is like an amount that they may be entitled to, and then there's the super pro rata check, which is above the amount that they're entitled to. And if you have an inside investor that wants to put in a super pro rata, generally it's best for everyone involved to find an external fund to validate and set the price. Inside investor has an incentive to lowball you.
Yep.
And then on top of it, from a fund reporting perspective, it's better to have an external market clearing price set where they're not just marking their investment up for their LPs. So in general, you want to have an external lead and everyone kind of wins, because then you can create some competition and drive the price up and they're happy because they get the markup and those kinds of things.
Yeah, no, that's good advice. So who led the seed round?
Yeah, so the seed round was led by a fund out of LA called Crosscut.
Mm-hmm.
And we met Crosscut. They were connected, actually well connected to a couple of our existing institutional investors. They've primarily been based in the LA area, and now they're starting to branch out into San Francisco and New York. They just raised, I should know the number, I want to say $140 million fund. Sorry, Rick, if I gave you a couple extra million there, but it was a pretty large fund for their fourth fund. And we were one of the first, five investments.
I looked at it right before. 125, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, I kept marking the number up, but you know, somewhere in that north of $100 million phase, which is, you know, that's a lot of AUM compared to where they were coming from. And so they've been branching out. We were one of the early investments in that fund. And, you know, I think myself and the lead partner on the deal just connected really well, both on my experience and our vision for the company. And it was a very easy and seamless process with them. They've been great to work with and quick to close, which was nice.
That's great. Okay. And how many do you think you talked to in this round? Did the numbers go down as you already had?
Numbers went down a little bit. Yeah, I think we were in that, but we're still probably in that 40 to 60 contact range. You know, and this round was an interesting process. There were a few things that probably were inside baseball, but like, you know, one of the things that we were probably ready, or at least I was ready to start talking to investors in July and August, because we had early evidence of traction. It wasn't externally obvious, but I felt like the numbers were going in the right direction and we had a good story to tell. But nobody wants to go fundraise in July and August. So we started in September. And then, you know, the first kind of story we took out to the market didn't kind of fully capture the vision. And this happens a lot. I think every entrepreneur will have adjustments to their pitch throughout the fundraising process. And ours just took us, you know, the first 4 to 5 weeks of meetings until we finally kind of dialed in the pitch. And so, you know, we started in September. It probably was around early to mid-October when we got the story nailed and we started getting more responsiveness and more interest, and kind of people had the same, were more aligned with the vision that we had. And then it was kind of a foot race to the holidays. And yep. So, you know, it definitely was one of those things where I don't think I could have started earlier, but the timing windows really matter, and understanding the cadence. And I think as an entrepreneur, I think it's actually important to understand the market timing for fundraising more than anything. And that's not to say you won't get a deal done in July and August, but you're not going to talk to 60 funds. So, you know, if you want to run a process and you want to have people engaged and you're competing with other deals and other attention, you kind of want to align with other people's schedules, which tend to fall into a spring and fall window for the most part. But I think that timing piece is something that I find first-time founders don't really appreciate. And they're like, it's June, and they're like, I'm going to go fundraise. And it's like, no, everybody's in the Hamptons on the East Coast. And on the West Coast, they're, you know, kite surfing, or they're somewhere else. Like, it's just, you know, people aren't around. And there are some people working. But I just think in terms of running a process, you're making something which could take a long time, possibly take longer, and you don't want to do that.
Yeah, I've had one or two other guys on this show talk about, like, the day after Labor Day, they started all their introductions, all their connectors made all the introductions to their target list, like the day after Labor Day, right? When everyone
got
back from Burning Man or whatever.
I waited a few days more because we didn't want to be lost in the inbox, but yeah.
That probably makes
pretty
sense.
Much that week.
Do you think it's, does Christmas week, I mean, I guess when would you almost put that fall fundraising season? September through early December, or I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, we actually saw people start to drop off by Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not at term sheet before Thanksgiving, it's probably not. I just think it's going to be tough to happen. So we saw a couple funds basically between Thanksgiving and Christmas, they start to tie up loose ends, and they're just not taking anything new, right? So it does, you know, September to Thanksgiving does shorten things down in Europe. You know, I've worked with companies in Europe. You actually can go into mid-December in Europe because you don't have that Thanksgiving bump. But yeah, it's kind of those 3 months.
And is there any seasonality between like January and June or July, or is it?
Yeah, I think there is. I think, you know, I think people come back the middle of January. There's typically like a ski week in February where, you know, kids are out of school and people are off and investors are in Vail or Telluride or wherever they go. And, you know, and then there's kind of a sprint till the end of May until Memorial Day. And so I do think there's a window kind of between January, middle of January and Memorial Day as well. It's a wider time frame. So generally, like, I think that's probably a little easier slot to hit. But yeah, I think there is seasonality there. And then, you know, Memorial Day, people open up their vacation homes and their second cabins and those kinds of things. And it, you know, people start to drift off again.
Yeah. Very interesting. Okay. Any other notable elements of the seed round that you want to discuss or, you know, war stories, any crazy thing happen along the way, or was it fairly straightforward?
I mean, I had one. Actually, this was pre-seed, but this one was pretty funny. So I was describing our product, right? And I was explaining kind of the problem we solve for the customer. And halfway through the meeting, the investor stopped me and he said, "Can I swear?"
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Halfway through the meeting, the investor stopped me and he said, "Oh, so this is a product only for shitty companies." And I said, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Well, if they have these problems, they're not well-run companies." And I just scratched my head and I'm like, "Well, obviously, A, you've never run a company before." Right. Which was true. And B, like, I actually don't think setting up software to take the job of humans is a bad practice. I think it's a good practice. Right. And so I started to close up and I said, you know, it's fine. Like, you don't have to like this. Like, it doesn't feel like there's a fit here. And he made me stay and he stopped me from leaving. He's like, "Oh, no, we haven't made our decision yet. Why don't you just finish?" Uh-huh. And I'm like, "Well, why would I do that?" And there was kind of this awkward thing. And I'm like, "All right, I'll just finish the rest of the pitch." You know, and of course he said no, but I'm like, "Why would you make me stay for another half hour when you clearly are already in the point of like, this is not a good thing," right?
Yeah.
Fortunately, we've signed up a couple of his portfolio companies. Mm-hmm. So he invests in shitty companies. But yeah, it was one of those moments where you just look back and you're like, wow. I have a lot of those, unfortunately, but that was one that was pretty funny where he actually wouldn't let me leave the room. He's like, no, sit down. Like, let's finish. And I'm like, you clearly don't get this. Like, why are we still talking? I can go like work on other things than trying to explain to you why, you know, this aren't for shitty companies. But yeah, it was pretty funny. So that one's stuck with me. Some of those things you end up taking a little more personally than you should. But there will be a point when I'll bring that one back out and we'll talk about it.
That's interesting. One question I had, you mentioned that, you know, you started in September and your story didn't like click at first. What did you change? Was it just making your pitch clearer? Did you change your framing of your market, or, you know, what did you change in your pitch?
Yeah. So that's an incredibly nuanced and detailed question, right? There's a few things that I can share about that. And like, this is what I was doing before I was actually like working on TeamPay, as I was helping companies tell their story and their pitch, right? Problem is, when you're doing it for yourself, it's like the gossip columnist that's a disaster, right? You just can't follow your own advice. And, you know, I think there are a few things. Like, one is, one of the mistakes we made, and I think every entrepreneur makes, is because you see the big picture with such crystallized clarity and detail, it's tempting to always talk about all the complexity in the big picture, right? I think every entrepreneur does that. And I think we had not, you know, as you said, simplified that down to kind of like the one thing and like really what it is. The second issue is, and this happens occasionally, is we were not building a better mousetrap. We were getting rid of mousetraps altogether. And that's really hard sometimes for people to understand if they've never had a mice problem.
Right.
So if you've never had a problem with mice, you know that mice mousetraps exist. You don't understand why they're a terrible solution. And we ran into that a lot.
Interesting.
Right? If you think about expense management and purchasing, most VCs are well-paid white collar professionals with platinum Amexes in their pocket, an office manager, and six people. That is not our target buyer. They are our worst customer, right? They have not had 200 people with multiple layers of delegation and somebody sharing a corporate card attached to a clipboard and writing in what they bought to it. And then the auditor is trying to reconcile that a month later. Like, they just hadn't had that experience. So I think connecting with people on that way was very difficult. And the bridge to doing that was working through an analogy, which you can argue is good or bad, but that's really what we had to do, was kind of the way that I talked about at the beginning of, like, you're familiar with single sign-on, you're familiar with source code control, you're familiar with a bunch of these other enterprise software tools, and yet none of them exist for the company's money. That little shift, it was the same product, the same pitch, the same solution, the same market, but that little shift about connecting the dots of, like, oh, you're right. Why don't I have a way just to turn on and off access to my money? And why don't I have a way to keep track of all the changes without, like, somebody pasting receipts or taking a picture and emailing it to someone? And so that was the piece that really unlocked that next stage. And it was a combination of me banging my head against the wall and an investor who kind of walked me through that. And we tested a bunch of these. We tested like three or four, and that was the one that stuck.
Yeah, it makes sense. I do like that single sign-on for a company's bank account. I think that's a
took me 14 months to do.
Yeah. That's right.
I didn't have it during the first round, and I didn't have it for part of the second round. So, I mean, that's the other thing too, is, like, as a founder and entrepreneur, you need to constantly be iterating your story. And you need to constantly be simplifying it. And you'll recognize when you get that aha moment.
Any tips for structuring the presentation and giving the live pitch that you want to share?
Yeah. So, you know, it comes back to some of the things I mentioned before, which is, I think it's really important to tell a story. And a lot of the advice you read online about structuring your deck is problem, solution, market, business model, like all these categories of slides, right? But this wasn't actually my idea. It was from someone else who's literally one of the best fundraisers I've ever met. They've probably raised over a couple hundred million of venture capital at very early stages. And, you know, there's this technique of using the title of the slide to tell the main point of the slide, and then using the slide itself to have supporting data points. And so it creates this really nice kind of T structure where you have the top, you know, of the slide is actually a statement. Because again, what you want a person to walk away with is an impression, right? So on my previous company, we were in this space around social discovery for places. And we had a kind of market trend slide, which talks about how social discovery was being used for YouTube and content and all these other areas, but social discovery had never been done for places. So I had this title of, like, places will be discovered by social discovery. Like, that's the statement that you want to remember. And then depending on if you're using PowerPoint or Keynote, I suggest Keynote simply because it always looks better. And, you know, even if you buy a Mac just to do your deck, you're spending a couple grand for $500 million of funding. And then so what you do is, in the outline view, you can go over the left, the outline view, and you should be able to read from the first slide to the last slide as if it was actually a story. And that's a really great way to structure the narrative. You want to cover all of those topics around problems, solution, market, team, traction, revenue, business model, all those things, right? But doing it in a way that's telling a story, and then each slide has the points underneath it, I think is, like, one of the most important things. There's a lot of great articles out there on storytelling, but, you know, usually you start with a problem and a conflict. And then I actually think it's important to have a trend. You need to answer the why now. Right, especially if you're doing something different. Why is this important now, and what are the trends coming in there? And then you talk about your solution maybe at a high level, and then you talk about your product. Too many people spend five slides talking about the product. The product is not the business, unfortunately. It's the people in the market that drive the product. So you want to spend as much time talking about the business and talking about the market and how you're going to access the market and all those things besides what features you have. I think, circling up, it's being able to tell a story across the titles of the slide, working through with supporting data, and then looking at that almost as a narrative and using good storytelling techniques when you do that pitch.
That's great. Thank you so much. All right, very good. I will let you go here, get back to building your business. But any last words of advice or advice you would give yourself, you know, your younger self, if you were doing this all over again?
No, I mean, I think it was a lot of the lessons that we learned, right? And it's one thing to hear it, but it's another thing to do it, right? And, you know, literally from day one, just setting up Founder Suite or setting up a CRM or setting up some way to track, running a process, potentially, you know, pitching investors in the beginning that you want to test on, iterating the story, knowing that it's going to change, and really, really simplifying things, right? What actually, I think in my mind, what wins an investment deal is the slides you take out of the deck, not the slides you put in it, right? And so I use the appendix very aggressively and really focus on, you know, can we create a compelling story around why this is an obvious, inevitable change in the world? And everything else is a backup. And that is, you know, that serves two purposes. One is it makes the investor look smart because they get to ask informed questions. And two, it makes you look prepared because you have the answer. But sometimes the only way to build that appendix is just by getting those questions. And so you build that over time. But you should never really change. You should never make the main narrative more complex. You should always be chopping and simplifying it.
I love that. I love that. That's so spot on. I think that's really great. This is great. Andrew, appreciate it. So if people want to learn more, it's teampay.co, correct?
That's correct. TEMPAY.co. Big on team, little on pay.co.
There we go. How many months did it take to come up with that little jingle?
Well, it's because people kept misspelling it, so I had to figure out a way. And nobody capitalizes Facebook on the B, so I'm like, look, you know, eventually people can learn. But yeah, once in a while I get to be, you know, we had this thing when we started, we make things for teams and labs, but not for lab people in labs, but for teams and labs, and we like grammar. And so, you know, there's a bit of grammar and design police that goes around the office at times, and the team pay jingle was part of it.
I like it. I like it. All right, Andrew, this has been great. Thank you so much. Best of luck with TeamPay, and we'll catch you after your next round. How about that?
That's great. Thanks so much, Nathan. Nice to meet you.
You too. Bye.